On February 27th in AD 380, an entirely new era began in Europe. On that date, Emperor Theodosius issued the Edict of Thessalonica, making Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire. This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, Director of Distance Learning at Wyoming Catholic College, and you're listening to the After Dinner Scholar, the college's weekly podcast about the great books and the liberal arts. The Edict of Milan, signed by Emperors Constantine and Licinius in AD 313, granted the Roman people freedom to choose any religion they wished, including the previous outlawed religion of Christianity. Then in 380, Theodosius outlawed everything except Christianity. And so it was for much of the next 1600 years since Theodosius. Catholic Christianity was the state religion of every state in Europe, and even after the rise of Protestantism, cuius regio, eius religio, whose realm, his religion, was the order of the day. Religious freedom was still a new and novel idea when it became part of the U.S. Constitution, and as the idea spread, it was also a controversial idea. Dr. Kent Lisnowski has been leading Wyoming Catholic College seniors into the conversations about religious liberty in the Catholic Church, and he's our guest this week on the After Dinner Scholar. Dr. Lisnowski, give us a working definition of religious freedom. What are we talking about?
Well, in the Second Vatican Council, the Catholic Church defined religious freedom as a kind of immunity from coercion on the part of individuals or groups and of any human power, so that no one is forced to act in a manner contrary to his own beliefs, whether publicly or privately, alone or in association, or all within due limits. So that's kind of a modern Catholic definition. But I think the more longstanding traditional definition that you would find would be that, and this would be a more universal definition, would be to say that religious liberty is really, it's the right to fulfill one's duty of worshiping God as one ought to. And that means in accord with what God has revealed to us about himself and the manner in which we ought to worship him through reason and through special revelation.
While the Dignitatis Humanae, the Church affirmed, quote, the human person has a right to religious freedom, and the right to religious freedom has its foundation in the very dignity of the human person, 80 years earlier, the Church, in the person of Leo XIII, seems to have been saying, well, if not just the opposite, certainly something else. Justice forbids, wrote Leo in his encyclical Libertas, and reason itself forbids the state to be godless or to adopt a line of action which would end in godlessness, namely to treat the various religions, as they call them, alike, and to bestow upon them promiscuously equal rights and privileges. What did Leo teach, and how does that square with Vatican II?
So Pope Leo XIII wanted to say that the state's job is to care for and protect a just social order and the common good. Now, the first demand of justice upon any person is to give to God what is God's due. Well, that's worship. And since worship is a universally knowable duty of justice, it pertains, therefore, to the state to see that structures and laws whereby the fulfillment of that duty is made easier and is promoted come to be, while at the same time, those structures that would make its opposite, that is, not worshiping God, things that would make its opposite easy should be discouraged or even punished. Right? So because there's this level of justice, we owe God worship, the state being concerned with justice and the duties of man must have a care for proper worship as well. Now, how does that square with Vatican II? Well, it squares with Vatican II in a number of ways, but I think the first is to say that the Church sees in 1965 that the best way a state can ensure and put in place structures that allow people to worship according to their duty is to make a space for them to operate on the dignity of discovering and affirming the true religion themselves, according to their conscience. That is, to give them an opportunity to meet God authentically and to assent to and love God by their own journey. And there's a kind of witness to human dignity built into that, right? So the state is still responsible, according to the Second Vatican Council, to promote and make true worship possible and easier. However, the focus has been on creating a space where people can come to that on their own, rather than legislating certain things more forcefully.
Now, what happened between 1888 and Leo XIII and 1968, the Vatican Council?
The world changed in so many ways in those years. One of the things we saw is a further division between church and state in many countries. We saw world wars, World War I, World War II. We saw religion moving away from the center of folks' identities in their neighborhoods, in their societies, in their schools. The church was becoming, well, churches were becoming more and more comfortable with having been relegated to the setting of being voluntary associations, right? They became comfortable as sort of extracurriculars for people, so to speak. Not really who I am or what I am, but something I do on the side. And that became more and more the way folks were used to seeing church. Now, another piece is the rise of communism. So now we've got a totally different problem on the scene. You've got situations where no religion is allowed. Okay, so the church has to deal with that problem, right? So instead of saying, no, the state has to promote the right religion, now in the 60s, the church is saying, hey, you have to let people worship some way. And so you see there's been a kind of pendulum shift there, swing there, to the other side or the other extreme, right? You have the extreme of relativism. Well, all religions are just as good. Anybody can worship them. The church is going to push on that. No, there is a true religion. At the same time, the other side of the pendulum swing, no religions are allowed at all. They're evil. Well, the church is going to push on that, right? No, of course, there is a true religion and we must allow it. So I think those are some historical developments that we see that affect the way the church chooses to express its teaching in the Second Vatican Council.
And so if there's going to be freedom for Catholic churches, there has to be freedom for everybody else.
Indeed.
Now, while I'm the author of a book about the importance of religious freedom, let me play, as they say, the devil's advocate. Doesn't religious freedom necessarily carry with it a relativism or a universalism? That is, a relativism that says any religion is as good as any other religion, or the presumption that everybody is saved?
I would say the short answer is yes. What you have is a kind of practical relativism at the very best, with the church still affirming itself as the true religion, and it would ask the state to still affirm it as the true religion, ultimately. And Pope Leo XIII in Immortale Dei says the state has a duty to profess the true religion. But it seems that the state has to, and the church concedes to this in the current context, operate with a kind of practical relativism in the face of what's happened to culture in the Enlightenment. And we can't put that back in the box, this radical trust in reason, the radical trust in raising up of human dignity of choice. You know, these things we can't do away with them. They're here to stay. And so the church is going to say, well, it's worth the risk because we have the benefit of having people who come to this more authentically on their own instead of being forced to come to the true religion. Now, the problem with all this, of course, is that while you may actually believe there is a true religion, when you concede to a practical relativism, when you act as if there's no true religion, you end up slowly educating people, right? So you can only act a certain way so long before you start believing the way you act. And I think we're seeing the fruits of that today.
Well, isn't it also we have a notion of tolerance or toleration that comes out of a nihilism, a sense that you can't know, therefore everyone has to be tolerant, rather than a notion, even coming from the church fathers of toleration, that said, because God does not coerce, even though he is truth, we're not in a position to coerce either. In other words, you tolerate error because there is truth and you know the truth. I mean, it seems to me that that's gotten very blurred as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed it has. And I think what you would notice, if you go back to the Enlightenment and the original kind of zeal for religious liberty, you notice that even those folks actually would have thought atheism is illegal. If you look at the letter of for toleration by Locke, you find that he says atheism can't be tolerated. So somehow, even in the early Enlightenment days, the right of freedom of religion was tied up with a duty. The duty of all men and the duty of society to worship God. And so I think what's happened finally is that we've had enough practical atheism over the years and enough influence of the nihilistic approach that you're speaking of, which is beyond the agnostic approach, that we've come to a place where the right of freedom of religion is divorced from our duty to worship. Because frankly, we don't act as if there is a duty to worship anymore. And so when you divorce the right of freedom of religion from the duty to worship, you get the kind of consequences we have today, right? And that's where you end up with a kind of universalism. Mm-hmm. Right.
John Paul II liked to say, we never impose, we only propose. Contrast that idea with what we've been talking about. God doesn't coerce, not even back in the Garden of Eden, and we can't coerce either.
I think what you have here is the radical faith that the Catholic Church puts in the cooperation of human nature with grace. That if a person authentically looks inward to human reason, what he discovers there is a natural law, a participation that he has in the very mind of God. And it's there by a gift of God, that his very reason is a participation in God's way of seeing and organizing the world. And thereby, if he authentically asks the right questions, he will discover the truth. And he will feel compelled in his conscience to make a right judgment about what he must do. And the Catholic Church has never flagged in its trust for that. And I think that's part of the reason that in the modern era, the Catholic Church has been more tolerant of a wider religious liberty, because we believe in the compelling and the compelling power of the truth. It does set you free, and that it is attractive, and that there's no way that man can erase from his heart the very question of what is good, what is true, what ought I do, what must I do, and that if he seeks for it honestly, he will find it.
Now, on this topic, if our listeners want to learn more, what two or three church documents might they read?
I would suggest digging back 130 years or so to get a fresh look at this. I think everyone kind of thinks they understand religious liberty. Thinks, oh, yeah, I got that one. But if you read, I'll suggest two documents that maybe might surprise some folks. So Immortale Dei and Libertas Prestantissimum by Leo XIII, these two documents, right at the end of the 19th century. They discuss religious liberty, and they discuss liberty more broadly. What is freedom? And I think so often we think we understand what the church really teaches on liberty, but it remains something that's a shock when people dig into some of these older encyclicals. So I would suggest people go to those, and then also Dignitatis Humanae from the Second Vatican Council, which is the more modern expression of the church's teaching on religious liberty.
True freedom, wrote St. John Paul II, is not advanced in the permissive society, which confuses freedom with license to do anything whatever, and which, in the name of freedom, proclaims a kind of general amorality. It is a caricature of freedom to claim that people are free to organize their lives with no reference to moral values, and to say that society does not have to ensure the protection and advancement of ethical values. Such an attitude is destructive of freedom and peace. And it is in just such a society that we live. Thus, balancing religious freedom for all religions or for no religions with the ongoing freedom to proclaim spiritual and moral truth becomes increasingly difficult. In fact, it has become one of the greatest challenges of our era. If you'd like to learn more about religious freedom, specifically religious freedom in America, visit the Wyoming Catholic College website, wyomingcatholic.org, and request a free copy of the distance learning course, Religious Liberty in America. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.